Union Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
With early detection comes early prevention.
Put lead in your pencil, feel like a champion.
Rise up again, let nothing keep you down. To live your best,
every urologist speak.
Oh yeah, oh,
think you're losing grip of your manhood. Don't give up on
keep
hope
up.
Don't be ashamed, it's time to take control. Get some
help, you will find
he'll help you solve your problems
on 96.9, yeah.
I'm telling you, with early detection
comes early prevention.
Put lead in your pencil, make you feel like...
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto. Unfortunately, my co-host, Dr. Wesley Francis, is being called away on emergency surgery again. That's the life that's going to happen. But we're very pleased to have in the studio today the ear, nose, and throat specialist and surgeon, Dr. Charles Johnson Jr. I'm sure a lot of Bahamians know the name Dr. Charles Johnson, but this is Jr. They're both ENT surgeons, so I'm going to let you welcome, first of all, Dr. Johnson, and tell the nation a little bit about yourself.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Dr. Charles Jeremy Johnson Jr. It's such a pleasure to be here on the show, Dr. Pinto. Thank you for welcoming me. So I am an ear, nose, and throat surgeon, endoscopic sinus surgeon. We usually deal with patients that have issues with sinusitis as well as sleep disorders such as sleep apnea, from A to Z, from diagnosis to therapeutic resources such as the CPAP machine as well as surgeries to help you sleep better. Conditions of the ear, nose, and throat such as ear infections, as well as head and neck cancer. That's a big one that's plaguing our country right now. So oral cancer, conditions associated with smoking and alcohol, and then endocrine issues such as thyroid and parathyroid. So I'm just so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. We've spoken many times on this show over many months about obstructive sleep apnea. It's an overwhelming pandemic in this country. A lot of persons, unfortunately, don't even understand what the obstructive sleep apnea is and what it can lead to. It can increase your risk of cardiovascular death exponentially. It can reduce the quality of your life. Essentially, you stop breathing for a few seconds. Your body's taken out of REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, put into superficial non-REM sleep. You're getting elements of hypoxia, where there's poor blood supply and perfusion to many organs, including your heart, your brain, your lungs, your everything. So it can be disastrous. It's essentially eating away at yourself. You're going to feel fatigued because you could have slept 10 hours and you feel like you slept 1 hour. Many patients with severe sleep apnea will actually remark they feel more fatigued when they wake up than when they first went back to sleep.
That's right.
When they first went to sleep. So, and it can be a real toll on the partner because there's loud snoring.
That's right.
There's that fear that the snoring stops and you stop breathing for a few seconds.
That's right.
So tell us, as an ear, nose, and throat specialist, what exactly is obstructive sleep apnea? And obviously there's central sleep apnea, but from your perspective, what are the main causes of obstructive sleep apnea and who are usually afflicted?
Right. So with this obstructive sleep apnea, OSA is a term thrown around by a lot of specialists, and we try to get these patients to have a better quality of sleep and a better quality of overall life. These patients are usually a bit overweight, and you know our population sometimes we're on the heavier end, and we're still in the community on the force, in the workplace, trying to conduct our jobs and falling asleep on the jobs. So I get a lot of patients coming in with daytime tiredness, saying that they're trying to stay awake and conduct their job, but they have reduced concentration, reduced productivity. And this all comes, like we said, from a lack of oxygen to the brain at nighttime from some obstruction. Usually this obstruction is within the nasal airway, starting as anteriorly as the nasal valve, the internal nasal valve, and throughout the sinuses. Patients with sinusitis and nasal obstruction can have obstruction of airflow, and then going posteriorly towards the soft palate and the uvula, where there's maybe swelling and inflammation causing an obstruction. and then going further down, closer to the windpipe, where you have a large tongue or even tonsils obstructing the airway. So all of these points, it can be usually is a combined effort of obstruction and multi-level obstruction that needs to be dealt with. So a lot of times, even when we try to treat these patients, you have to have that understanding that it's multiple levels of obstruction and not just one pinpoint of obstruction.
And then men, women, and even some children are afflicted with obstructive sleep apnea, and it will actually shorten your lifespan. That's the most important. That's a key message to take home.
Yes.
Don't just suffer needlessly. It might be an annoyance to listen to the snoring, or maybe you'll have your wife or your spouse put on headphones or earplugs or whatever, but all you're doing is drowning out something that's slowly killing your loved one, whether it's your wife or your girlfriend or your husband or your boyfriend or whoever it is. Let's allow them to die slowly. Yes. Seek help, because their quality of life, and then for men, I've mentioned it many times, it lowers your testosterone.
Yes.
The testosterone that you use up throughout the day should be replenished during REM sleep. You're not getting sufficient REM sleep. A lot of persons will remark that not only they feel fatigued all the time, but because they don't have REM sleep, they don't even have dreams. So that they're void of dreams. They don't know the last time they had a good night's sleep. They don't know the last time they actually dreamt. And for men, it can affect their erections because their testosterone is always on the low side. It can affect their whole personality because they're irritable, they're depressed. They don't have that drive to do things anymore. Their sexual drive is very poor. With the low testosterone, they're going to put you at risk of going into metabolic syndrome.
Right.
So if you don't have diabetes or hypertension or high cholesterolemia, you'll be at risk of it. You can have insulin resistance. If you had diabetes, it'll be more difficult to control. You can just essentially, in a matter of months, put on 40 pounds.
That's right.
And you don't know why or how, and there's no way to lose it. You're losing muscle mass. You'll notice you're losing hair on your arms, your legs. You're not shaving as often as you used to.
That's right.
So it can take away your manhood, essentially. Yeah. Let's just summarize it that way. And it can make you a shell of your former self. You don't recognize the body that you're inhabiting because all of a sudden you're a weight you've never seen. You have to buy all new clothes.
That's right.
You feel embarrassed. You don't have any sexual drive. You can't achieve or maintain an erection. You don't want to do anything anymore. All you want to do is sleep. And you can't even watch TV because every time you sit down to watch TV, the TV is watching you.
That's right.
It can get so severe that there are persons who actually are going to get into car accidents. It gets so severe that people are fighting sleep at the stop sign.
Right.
And they have to pull over to the side of the road because they're going to nod off.
Yes.
And don't ever let it get to that point, please. Mm-hmm. You don't want to live with the fact that you killed someone or loved one in the car. Seek help because this is destroying your life. And what a lot of middle-aged men will do is they'll drink caffeine every hour on the hour.
And they're
already at a risk of not emptying their bladder because of age-related benign prostate hyperplasia, which is preventing them from having that strong stream and emptying the bladder completely. So all the caffeine does is cause them to pee incessantly, urgently, frequently. So not only are they fatigued, the caffeine will get you through a day, an hour or 2 hours, and then you're going to crash and feel even more fatigued than before you took the coffee. What can you do surgically if you find an obstruction that can remedy this massive problem in this country?
Right. So thorough assessment of these patients will lead to surgeries that can actually help their symptoms. You may have patients, unfortunately, that may have been told if they fix one problem or another area of problem that they will relieve symptoms. And after the procedure, they may still be having sleep apnea symptoms. But surgically, you have to assess whether there's any deviation of the nasal septum, whether there's any enlarged turbinates. There are the bags within the nose that actually warm the air as the air passes through the nose. These can actually overgrow, causing an obstruction. And so therefore, these patients are mouth breathing all the time. That can be corrected surgically with use of endoscopic instruments, as well as what's common and historically known as soft palate surgery. So when you open the mouth in the mirror and you look at the back of the throat, you may see the punching bag dangling at the back of the throat. So historically, we used to remove this along with some of the soft palate procedure in that airway. So with this present technology, we've kind of modified that approach to reshaping that soft palate. And we can use various types of instruments, such as coblation or even laser, to help with that. But usually, most of our surgery lies within the sinus and the soft palate. Going down towards the tongue, the tongue can be large in some people, and so therefore we do have submucosal muscular techniques to reduce the size of the tongue, or we can even remove a segment of the tongue. These are more extreme procedures for extreme patients. As we've mentioned, some people present in really dire states. They can't stay awake on the job. They're literally falling asleep at the red light, and they may have caused an accident in the past. So these type of patients would have already been on CPAP therapy, which is a machine that you go that goes over the face, that keep the airway open, and have failed therapy. And so these more extreme procedures are saved for those patients. Additionally, it's gotten so bad to the point where we have had to bypass the entire airway in patients to save a life and actually perform tracheostomy in some very obese patients that have been harboring carbon dioxide within their system for too long and have presented in a coma state. So it can range from very minor procedures within the nasal cavity and oropharynx to extreme procedures that need to save people's life.
Yeah, so obstructive sleep apnea reduces the quality of your life. It reduces significantly longevity of your life. For men, they're going to lose the most important organ use in their lifetime, and that's going to lead them to have erectile dysfunction. So don't go down that path. Don't die needlessly at 58 years old or 52 years old when it was sleep apnea that caused you to have the stroke, that caused you to have the heart attack, that robbed you of quality years on this earth because you develop diabetes because of the low testosterone, the metabolic syndrome with sleep apnea. And it's a vicious cycle. Low testosterone can lead to obesity. Obesity can lead to sleep apnea. Sleep apnea leads to low testosterone that in turn leads to obesity. You get on that vicious cycle. And there are hundreds, if not, I won't even say thousands of Bahamian residents who are actually suffering needlessly from this plague in our society. And we all see them. We want to know why our aunt is all of a sudden 320 pounds. Why is she withdrawn from the family and socially awkward and depressed and always falling asleep at the drop of a hat? Yes. Why all of a sudden is she suffering from diabetes? And why all of a sudden does she have uncontrolled hypertension? This is something that we can see. It doesn't happen in one day. If you have sleep apnea and you see it's how it's affecting your health, please seek help. There are solutions. And if you don't, it's not going to end well. In some regard, whether it's shortening your lifespan, whether it's causing you to have a heart attack or a stroke, you don't want to see a physician. You're going to allow this to allow you to have a stroke 20 years from now and leave you hemiplegic and a economic and emotional burden on your family. Please don't go down that road. How often do you see this in children, or is it really only children with obesity?
So obstructive sleep apnea is quite common in children, but it's treated entirely different. The most common cause of the obstruction in the child is the throat and the tonsils that grow very large proportionately to the size of the child's airway. Some children are lucky in the fact that if they're not treated, they actually outgrow the obstructive symptoms. But some children, the age of 2 or 3, have it so severely that we do have to intervene. So one of the common diagnoses that we see is upper airway obstruction to adenotonsillar hypertrophy. What we would normally do for those patients is remove their tonsils and adenoids surgically, and this improves their symptoms straight away. We must remember on a background of allergy as well as sinusitis that cause these adenoids and tonsils to enlarge initially. So you have to realize that you have to treat a hyperallergenic person, all right, that is atopic, meaning they are very high stimulants in the environment that cause their tonsils to enlarge right away. So they may have symptoms of tonsil and adenoid obstruction, but also nasal symptoms. And so we do treat those patients not so much with sinus endoscopic surgery because they're young and growing, but we normally treat the sinuses with medication such as nasal sprays and sometimes syrups and tablets that contain antihistamines to decrease the inflammation. But usually, tonsils and adenoids is one of the mainstays of an ENT surgeon.
So snoring is very common across the board, males, females, children. What should be considered abnormal in terms of loved ones witnessing someone snoring? I mean, some persons are just snoring because they're overly fatigued, et cetera, but when you're seeing someone, that you see them stop breathing, do you see them stop snoring? Is that the main concern in terms of obstructive sleep apnea? Is some element of snoring considered normal?
Yes, so snoring is a type of sleep disorder, right? But does it always need to be treated? It doesn't always need to be treated. The question to ask is this patient getting restful sleep or is this patient not having restful sleep? The patient not having restful sleep, something needs to be done. The snoring is the symptom of something greater. So you always want to streamline your history with these patients into how many hours of sleep are they getting, even though they snore. I have patients come to me, complain, told you you snore. They would say their loved one, their husband, their spouse, or so forth. And so I would ask them secondly and follow up with, well, are you sleeping well? And so those patients, some of those patients would say, oh, doc, I'm sleeping fine. I wake up rested. I'm productive. I'm not falling asleep. You know, look at me. I'm a BMI of 25. And so for those patients, yes, I would counsel them on any obstructive point and teach them all of the obstructive pathways of the upper airway. But I would not recommend that they do anything major to appease somebody else. Now, they do have symptoms of sleep apnea, and they're not getting restful sleep, right? I would ask them about how many hours they sleep a night. Is it fragmented? Do they wake up to pee a lot? When you wake up rested, right? Some patients sleep with the TV on and have very poor sleep hygiene, which has a part to play at night and snoring. So, you know, we would encourage good sleep hygiene. And the main thing, do they wake up rested? And if not, then we dive to sleep apnea symptoms.
And a lot of patients find that losing weight will also help, particularly if you're obese or morbidly obese, help with sleep apnea.
Definitely.
Is that part of the regime in terms of treatment?
Definitely.
Weight loss?
Okay. Definitely. So when they come into the room, right, now, you know, I love my Bahamian people and we do have an arm diet, right, but we do eat a lot of carbohydrates that would help our BMI to be a bit more advanced in other countries. So I do have that discussion with them, height for weight, BMI, right? So if the patient is of a neck diameter of over 40 centimeters, so sometimes if I do realize a sleep apnea patient, I would measure the neck circumference, and I would also get them on a weight loss regime. This regime is not meant to scare the patient into losing 60 pounds in 60 days. This has to be something maintained over a decade. So for the first year, they would get a plan, and then on to the first 5 years to keep the weight off. So the idea of encouraging a patient to lose weight is not to lose weight rapidly, but even if they lose 5 pounds, to keep that 5 pounds off for at least a year so that they don't go in the next direction. The idea is to watch your weight. If you step on the scale every week, you know what you are, you know what you're up against. But if you don't step on the scale, you could very well gain 15 pounds and go in the wrong direction. So I always encourage a dietitian referral. I always encourage stepping on the scale to know where you are and coming down to your ideal weight.
Well, we just mentioning it's a vicious cycle, obesity and sleep apnea. But what is your experience? Is it usually someone who has sleep apnea first and then becomes obese, or is it the other way around, or is it...
Well... It's connected to allergy and sinusitis. A lot of people sleep poorly because of, we live in a tropical climate, they have sinus symptoms, nasal congestion. And then also to our culture of diet and gain weight, our average BMI is upwards of 30. So therefore, we as a nation need to bring that down. But usually they present with a BMI of about 40, 45. Okay. Most of these patients that present with marked symptoms have a neck circumference of greater than 40. And so that's one of the main things, especially with the men that present. For some reason, females don't present as often as the men do, probably because the wives send their husbands in, right? But the men that come in, they're usually very tall, very heavy set, and can stand to lose a few pounds. And so we want to be sensitive to the fact that it's hard to lose weight, but at the same time, it's beneficial for their sleep and overall general health to lose that weight.
There are a lot of advertisements, particularly coming out of the U.S., in terms of implantable devices for treatment of obstructive sleep apnea.
Yes.
Can you give us some insight into that?
Yes. So the tongue, as I said, can be very large. And in heavy people, when they lay supine or flat on their back, the tongue can fall back. And so what we've aimed to do, especially as a part of my training, is to find the nerve that protrudes the tongue, okay? So that hypoglossal nerve is the name of the nerve. It protrudes the tongue. And what we do is we put a stimulator on that nerve, on the anterior branch of that nerve, to protrude the tongue at nighttime. And that hypoglossal nerve stimulator has a sensor, all right? And once it realizes that the pharynx is closing or oxygen levels are getting low, it actually stimulates that nerve, and that nerve would protrude the tongue, then opening the airway. So that hypoglossal nerve stimulation is very effective in the studies coming out of the UK as well as United States. And so I myself am working with a surgeon out of Minnesota to do those type of procedures, and it's very effective. I do think it's a very niche and unique surgery. Not everybody needs it, but it has a very important role.
I mean, the most common complaint is patients realize they have sleep apnea, that they realize how it's all the ill effects it's having on their life on every level, but they just cannot sleep with a CPAP machine. They find it uncomfortable. They find it burdensome. If they travel a lot, to be lugging it around is almost impossible. Are these the type of people where you would say, you know what, maybe you need to have some kind of interventional surgery?
Certainly. So I do encourage the use of this pneumatic splint, the CPAP machine. I would say about 40% of patients are compliant. The other 60%, and that's hundreds of thousands of patients, do not like it. We've tried to change the applicator that goes over the mouth and nose to something that goes just over the nose, and you can play with it to see which one, the tissue on examination, the CT scan and nasendoscopy looks fine. Why is this patient having obstruction, you know? Is it just loss of tonicity? And so we would get them on the CPAP machine, and then based off of that, once they're not compliant, then we may consider further investigation prior to surgery, such as drug-induced sleep studies, where we can actually look at the collapse and opening of the airway while they're asleep. And that can give us an idea of what level is collapsing and what we can do. Because you don't want to do a implant for glossal protrusion when they have a retropalatal obstruction. So it's really good to pinpoint the point of obstruction before attacking it with a surgery.
I do have some patients who couldn't tolerate CPAP machines, and they have basically go to a dental impressionist, get a mold, and then they get a jaw adjustment advancement device,
yes,
which they wear. Mm-hmm. Because it's made to fit them with the mold in their mouth, they find it a lot more comfortable. What do you see the success? Is it really only for mild obstructive sleep apnea of this jaw advancement device?
So, again, back to the clinical examination, you would look at mid-face length, you would look at lower third of the face length, and if the patient does have some degree of retrognathia or a small jaw or some degree of a large tongue that the protrusion can help, right, that's usually the first step prior to any surgical modality for the lower third. Now, that works on some patients, but it's not a one-fits-all. We have different devices by many different companies used to protrude the jaw. It can be custom made from the dentist, but you have some that you can buy and adjust. These are, I would say, some of them in vogue and then fall out of vogue. But once you can protrude that jaw, you should get some degree of opening. The idea is to remove that tongue off of the posterior pharyngeal wall. And so the implant, the device, there are other devices and even other surgeries. So for patients that we see that the device has worked and we have done X-ray studies and see that their measurements are short jaw, we can actually advance that jaw with a surgery. It does require some degree of bone cutting. We have to cut the mandible a little bit and advance that jaw. Additionally, if there is retropalatal obstruction, we can advance the mid-face. And even in younger patients with some deformities, such as in Treacher-Collins syndrome and so forth, we can use distraction methods at a young age to move those bones anteriorly so that we widen that posterior space. So definitely the device is something that we do use.
Well, first of all, as in urology, ENT, I know a lot of it is minimally invasive. And yes. Bayman patients in particular don't want to hear about pain and
right.
recovery and all that. So we're saying that the worst case scenario that is usually textbook, you won't see it for many years in your practice. But for the vast minority of patients, this is minimally invasive intervention that can change their quality of life.
Definitely. So I specialize in endoscopic sinus surgery. And a lot of the obstruction within the nasal passage, we can do with a minimally invasive technique to widen that nasal passage. And even at the retropalatal or in the, behind the soft palate, it's a transoral approach with no external scars. We can do all of our work internally so that when you heal up, you don't have any external scars and you do have the desired results.
I think we've gone through obstructive sleep apnea comprehensively. I thank you for all that information, a lot of things I've learned myself. But take-home message for men who we're primarily trying to reach out to because they never take care of any care of their own health. If you don't address obstructive sleep apnea, it's eventually going to rob you of years of your life. But more importantly, for you who are listening, it's going to rob you of your erections. So let that be the motivation for you to seek some help. Yes, and on top of you getting your erections back, you're going to lose that 20, 30 pounds. You're going to feel more rested. You're going to be more productive in your life. You heard everything else, but you want the motivation, sleep better, feel better rested, and get your erections back on track. So let's change the topic. A lot of younger persons you're going to see, is it because of those who need TNAs, who have recurrent tonsillitis?
Yes.
It's very common, and this can affect a child in so many levels. First of all, they're always feeling ill. They're losing a lot of school time. They're falling behind academically. They're just unwell all the time. At what point do you pull the trigger and say, all right, you need surgical intervention?
Right. So, yeah, T's and A's are so common. When I would decide to usually do surgery, it would be where the symptoms definitely are overwhelming to the family, and the benefit would outweigh the risks. It's a very low-risk surgery, and so I have infective indications. So patients with recurrent infections, normally, by the guidelines, and normally if you have more than 7 infections in a year for some children, or more than 5 infections in 2 years, or more than 3 infections for the last 3 years, I would normally say this is a candidate for surgery. If a patient has an obstructive cause, children do have episodes of apnea where they just lie still for 10 seconds without breathing and the mother would shake them in fear. Those type of patients that snore, those type of patients that do have some degree of air infections because the back of the throat is connected with the middle ear. And so those patients with large tonsils and adenoids usually have obstruction of the tube that connects, called the Eustachian tube. And so they would present with recurrent middle ear infections. And what this does, it causes a hearing loss in these children. And so by the time they're 3 or 4, they're not speaking as well as they should be. And so this brings a problem for the learning curve of the child. And so those as well would need intervention, not just the tonsils and adenoids, but also we do a procedure called meningotomy, where we place tubes in the ears to allow the fluid to have egress. And almost instantly their hearing comes back and they're able to catch up. So basically for infectious causes, obstructive causes, and then the hearing loss.
And another health pandemic in this country, and everybody knows somebody who has chronic sinusitis. They live their life on amoxicillin, they live their life on Augmentin. It doesn't ever seem to get any better. They're miserable all the time. It affects them socially, professionally. It affects their sleep, everything. It basically negatively impacts the quality of their life and their health in general. How do you intervene as an ENT surgeon in terms of someone who has recurrent sinusitis, chronic sinusitis, and just never seem to get better? Obviously, sometimes you need to get specific imaging. Mm-hmm. You may have abscess collections from my days rotating through ENT.
Yes.
Sometimes you need to have interventions. Who needs to see an ENT surgeon? Obviously, once off, doesn't have to go and see you, but what would indicate that someone needs to see an ENT specialist?
So what we would call chronic is usually longer than 12 weeks, so 3 months. So if patients are having symptoms of headaches, symptoms of nasal congestion, symptoms of cold dripping down the back of the throat, such as a post-nasal drip, patients that may be having facial pain or tenderness, patients that may be having loss of smell, even nosebleeds, patients that may be having allergy symptoms that are out of keeping with a usual flu-like symptom, I would recommend that they come and see an ENT. Quite often when the patient is referred to the ENT is after they've seen the family doctor, the community doctor, different doctors, and have been on a myriad of medications, but still having this chronic symptom return. And so it's incumbent on myself to pick up the allergy history of this patient, because sinus is all on a background of allergy. And if we were to shrink down to cellular level and we look at the type of cells involved, you can see how sinus can be treated, right? By blunting that eosinophilic response or that allergic response. And so therefore, it's not just a surgical treatment, but a medical understanding of the patient's allergy profile. So those that have known allergy, or they don't know what the allergy is, but they are symptomatic all the time, I would recommend coming to an ENT.
And what about imaging? What imaging would be beneficial for you in terms of making a diagnosis and a management plan?
Right. So with imaging, we normally would use a CT scan of the paranasal sinuses. When we're talking about the sinuses, there are two sinuses above the eyes, two sinuses below the eyes, two sinuses between the eyes, and then two sinuses behind the eyes. So that's eight sinuses in total, and they all drain towards the back of the throat. And so when we do this CT scan, it actually allows them to see any obstruction or any cysts or polyps that may be inside of them. This is a bony labyrinth. And when we're usually draining the sinuses, this imaging is important for us to guide us to where we need to drain. And so it's very important for the CT scan to be done.
So let's also change another subject. That was very comprehensive. Thank you very much. Let's talk about another thing that plagues persons of all ages on the other end of the break. We're going to talk about ear infections. We'll talk on the other end of the break.
Guardian Media Group and Going Places Travel want to take you and three others on a 7-day cruise to Panama, Colombia, Curacao, and Aruba on Royal Caribbean's Serenade of the Seas. And here's the best part, no visa required. That's right, no visa required. You have four ways to enter, four ways to win. One, fill out the form in the Nassau Guardian. Two, listen to Star 106.5 and Guardian Radio 96.9. Three, follow us on Facebook and Instagram on Going Places Travel. It's June 27, 2025. So pack your bags, get ready to soak up the sun, and feel that ocean breeze. You and three loved ones sailing the high seas on a vacation cruise of a lifetime. Drawing is on July 4, 2025. Brought to you by the Nassau Guardian Media Group and Going Places Travel. Certain conditions apply. Airfare, taxes, and gratuities not included.
Why you look so mashed up, like clothes at the washer?
No, boy, just a hard day. What?
Hard day? What happened? The breakfast lady ran out of tuna and gritsy.
We need to start joking about everything, you know. This serious, boy. This real serious, boy.
Boy, what's serious? Tell me.
All right, well, today, boss gave us boy one big, big contract. And nobody else get a chance and nobody say nothing.
Boy, you know that ain't right. You know government contracts ain't supposed to go that way.
Yeah, but nobody saying nothing. Boss man just tell people to sign the papers. Then he sent me to meet his boy downtown and collect this envelope.
You need to tell somebody. You need to become a whistleblower.
You know he's a real man, but I never blow no whistle like he drunk all my life in Junkano.
No way. A whistleblower is someone who tells people what they see when they see something wrong happening at work.
But I ain't no whistleblower, and I ain't no snitch. I still wait there, you know.
But ain't nobody gonna know it's you. All you gotta do is call Crime Stoppers, or you could text them from inside the Crack Crime Bahamas app. They don't ask about you, and your call goes straight through to Miami, so nobody know who you is. And if you text, your message get mixed up like Kong Salad.
Call 308-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and this is Urologist Speaks on NASA Guardian 96.9 FM. We have in the studio Dr. Charles Johnson Jr., ENT, head and neck surgeon and specialist. We were talking about everything under the purview of his specialty, which is a lot, and a lot of health issues that too many Bahamians evolve needlessly with. And we're talking about ear infections, and that also affects a lot of us. Kids as well, otitis or externus, otitis media. When does someone need to see an ENT surgeon versus just seeing their pediatrician, for example, if you have an 8-year-old with recurrent ear infections?
Yes. So with the pediatric population, if they do realize the child cannot speak yet but is boxing the ears, they do take their child to a pediatric specialist and they place on antibiotics, and it doesn't resolve, then it's on the pediatrician to refer that patient to the ENT specialist. If you do have a patient that's older, able to talk, and falling behind in terms of speech or any hearing concern, they may be having recurrent otitis media infections causing hearing loss. That person also needs to be seen by an ENT. And then sometimes we swim and we realize, after a couple of days of swimming, we realize the air starts to drain. You have to take important notice of what color is draining out of the air. Anything orange, yellow, green, then you want to bring that child to the ENT. It could be an active infection. And this can play a role in how the child hairs later on in life. And so if anything, you want to catch it early so you can treat it and get rid of it at an early stage.
And how often do you see these young children? Is it very common to have ear infections? Does it go hand in hand with tonsillitis?
Yeah, so a lot of the middle ear infections where the fluid has nowhere to go because of the tonsil being so enlarged, that's quite common. So I would say there are guidelines for doing ear procedures while we do tonsils. So not everybody would get the tubes, but it's very common. Outside of the tonsils associated with ear infections, we do have a lot of kids that play, put things in the air, especially foreign bodies, and then they come a week later, 2 weeks later with a draining ear, and you pull something like a rubber, a piece of a pencil out of the ear. That's quite common as well. And then the usual middle ear effusion, again on the background of some obstruction or allergy, where the middle ear has fluid, it turns into pus, and then it perforates the drum, and then they present with leakage. So that's pretty common. I spend a good portion of my week cleaning out pediatric ears. So it's quite common.
Every week I try to dissuade men, particularly middle-aged men or retirees, from smoking cigars. I think
yes.
Cigarettes, of course, they'll be mindful that even though a cigar, they'll say they don't inhale. Talk to the audience, particularly the men out there, don't want to hear because they get angry at me. I hear reports that they're on the golf course saying, "Whoa, that damn Pinto saying that we can't smoke our cigars." But it's us as surgical specialists who see the cancers. And some of them, unfortunately, present stage 3, stage 4, and it's a very horrid death and a prolonged death. In and out of hospital, interventional surgeries, radiation, chemotherapy, etc. We're trying to prevent that from ever happening. And we don't want you to go through see your children, your wife, your nephew, your niece, your friends see you go through that as well. Because when you have a cancer, you don't suffer on your own. You don't suffer in isolation. The family, the nucleus of the family, everyone is affected.
Yes.
on some level. Mm-hmm. Please, let's talk about the risks of head and neck cancers and smoking.
Yes. So head and neck cancer is innately affected by smoking and alcohol consumption. So we do see a lot of oral cavity cancers, a lot of throat cancers of the voice box, as well as a lot of cancers in the back of the oral cavity called the oropharynx. So these cancers bear a not so great prognosis due to the fact that they do present late at the back of the throat in the oropharynx, usually presenting at stage 3 or 4 within our community. Once we catch a patient and start to treat that patient, we do have to go through a rigorous set of treatment, which can be debilitating to the patient in terms of chemotherapy and radiation. And so it's so incumbent that if you do feel any symptoms, such as a scratchy throat that's lasting longer than 2 weeks, you would come in. Any hoarseness of the voice box that lasts longer than 2 weeks, that you come in to have your endoscopy done so that we can view the voice box with a camera on a magnified television so we can see any lesions. Sometimes we don't chew tobacco as often in the Bahamas, but we do smoke. So sometimes patients may present with lesions in the mouth, in the cheek, on the tongue. The most common place we see here and globally is the lateral tongue, the side of the tongue. And so once we catch these lesions early, we can actually bear a good prognosis. But smoking does add to the burden of cancer disease within our country. The main thing for these patients is early detection. So if you do see anything that pops up inside the mouth, you need to come in if it's lasting longer than a week. Now, cancer of the head and neck does spread via lymph nodes to the neck and then to distant sites such as the chest, liver, and bone. And so within the neck, you may have lumps and bumps that you may see or feel. And so this is not normal. If you do notice a new lump in the side of your neck or on both sides, then you should consult your ear, nose, and throat surgeon, knowing that you do smoke. And the amount of smoke is directly related to your likelihood of going on to get cancer of the head and neck. So we normally have a cigarette pack that has 20. And so that's how we would normally count patients' cigarettes, smoking habits. Do you smoke a pack a day, half a pack, which would be 10, a quarter pack, which would be 5, or cigars, or even marijuana? So we want to take stock of your smoking history and correlate that with the examination.
So please, let's scare some of these men to stop smoking cigars. What are the horror stories? I mean, rotating through ENT, I remember the fungating masses.
Yes.
It can be a horror story.
Yes.
So there is nothing benign. There's nothing pleasant that's going to happen to you by smoking cigars. I'm sure your wife doesn't like you coming home smelling like cigars, smoke. So please, let's put the cigars down. Let's let you live that long life. For many men, they only start smoking cigars when they retire. You've worked all those years. Why die a needless, painful death because of cigar smoking? It's just not worth it.
That's right.
I mean, the Surgeon General in the U.S. actually put out a warning, or wanted to put out a warning. Obviously, he's going to have a lot of feedback from the capitalist society where liquor industry is going to fight back. But at least 6 different cancers are strongly linked to alcohol intake, and we're talking even moderate alcohol intake, and head and neck cancers fall under that as well. So we're a nation that drinks too much, we're a nation that smokes too much, we're a nation that's obese, we have overwhelming numbers of persons with obstructive sleep apnea and diabetes and many other non-communicable diseases. Thyroid disease is very a major issue as well. I know that thyroid in itself is a major topic, and I'm going to invite you back just to speak on that and some other topics. We're not going to get through everything in ENT in 1 hour, but let's just have the highlights in terms of thyroid disease, benign thyroid lesions, and malignant thyroid lesions.
Okay. So thyroid, as you say, is a very extensive topic. One of my baby topics that we spend numerous amounts of hours throughout the day studying. So for the take-home message for thyroid for the audience, I just want you to know that the thyroid does produce a hormone. It sits in the neck. It's shaped like a butterfly, and it produces this hormone that allows your metabolism to kick in for your heart health, for your gut health, for your your brain health, for your skin health, your hair health, everything, your reproductive health. So it's a very important set of hormones that the thyroid produces. So it's a vital vital part of your body. Sometimes this gland can malfunction, meaning it can be productive, overly productive, or underproductive. Now, sometimes it may work properly, but it may grow. The neck is a very confined space, so if it does grow, it may produce a lump or a large lesion, which can affect your swallowing, and if you leave it long enough, your breathing. So it can have a problem with form, or it can have a problem with function. And so we treat both of these problems with medicine as well as surgical options for thyroid. So every year when you do your physical, I need you to pay close attention to the thyroid function profile. It should be done at your physical. If there's any deranged labs, then you should consult both your ear, nose, and throat and the endocrinologist. We work hand in hand. And then if you do notice any enlargement of the neck or growths in the neck, in the anterior neck, you should consult an ear, nose, and throat surgeon. We do look at the lab work. We do look at an ultrasound. The ultrasound is pretty similar to that ultrasound that pregnant women go through. You get the jelly on the neck, and we can assess the thyroid and look for any lumps or bumps within the thyroid. Now, a lot of people will have lumps and bumps in their thyroid, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the thyroid is malfunctioning or that you need surgery. Okay, so we have done many studies to show that a lot of these lumps are benign, meaning friendly, not cancerous. About 5% of people out of everybody with thyroid lumps will have cancer. So that may seem like a small number, but it's enough for us to do due diligence and make sure we evaluate that lump. So it doesn't mean that you come in with a thyroid problem, you're going to get surgery. It just means that we have to do the due diligence, proper blood works, proper ultrasound, proper biopsies, proper nuclear scans, and then we can determine, and also based on your family history as well, and your prior history of any radiation or any difficulty swallowing, what we need to do for you. So the thyroid nodules, even though they're mostly benign, we have to follow it through, and even though we come back as not doing anything, we need to see you back in about 6 months to a year to just make sure it remains normal. So the thyroid is, although vast, and we can't say everything on it, you just need to take home that if you have a lump in the neck or in your physical, if the thyroid function tests are off, you should come and see the ENT.
And of course, we had to mention, don't rush to the conclusion in your mind and stay away because you think every lump is cancer. There are many very common benign, that's non-cancerous right, lesions in your neck and in your thyroid gland.
That's right.
So don't let fear saying you ignorance is bliss and something might be happening, but in most cases, there really isn't anything. But if you leave it, you can have issues like endocrine issues.
Yes.
You can have hyperthyroidism. You can have hypothyroidism.
Yes.
And that can affect you in so many ways. So please, first of all, always get your annual physicals. And yes, thyroid function is a must with every annual physical. And then you don't even need to ask for it. It just is just the automatic.
That's right.
So I always advocate, and I'm sure you're going to second that, that we want to have all preteens, teens, we can even advocate for those adults up to the age of 28 to get the HPV vaccine.
Yes.
As a ear, nose, and throat surgeon, Speak to me about the benefits of getting the HPV vaccine, because the HPV vaccine can prevent you from getting some head and neck cancers related to HPV, which is a disaster when it can be eradicated. Obviously, to cervical cancer, but it can have HPV vaccine can prevent you from getting head and neck cancers that can lead to your early demise.
Yes, HPV vaccine, such a beautiful vaccine. We have so many of them now. We have the 4-valent, the 9-valent, and the dual valent one. So what we have been offering in the ENT community as well as at large is the non-valent or 9-valent, which just means the 9 different serotypes that we can vaccine against. And in the ear, nose, and throat realm, there are benign issues that come about with this HPV-associated virus, such as respiratory papillomatosis, which can be a big burden of disease on the airway. These papillomatosis, they are small little bumps on your voice box, and they grow like a hedge, like a ficus, and they just bloom and bloom and bloom, and they block off the airway. So young children can contract this vertically and otherwise from their mother, who was not vaccinated at the time of birth, and so therefore their airway starts to have these cauliflower-like lesions on it. And it's very hard to manage. It's not something that you can take off once and they're done. Once you shave it down, it grows back like a haircut. And so you normally have to take these patients back to surgery every 6 weeks, every 2 months. And so the burden of disease is high. So I cannot stress the importance enough of this Gardasil vaccine, which is a 9-valent vaccine. Again, with head and neck cancer, it has been associated with oropharyngeal carcinoma, very closely associated with it, albeit the saving grace for that type of cancer is it bears a better prognosis than carcinogenic oropharyngeal carcinoma. The HPV-associated carcinoma of the oropharynx is associated with oral sex. And so fellas that, you know, would conduct that on multiple women, you know, they have a higher chance of getting that virus inside of their mouth, inside of the back of their throat. And normally the body, we do a process at the cellular level called methylation, where we would kind of get rid of this virus after 2 weeks. But if after constant barrage, if you're doing this activity with multiple women over and over, it becomes a time where this virus will integrate with your cells. Instead of getting rid of it, it actually integrates, and this can actually cause the cancer to grow. And so therefore, this vaccine is vital in our population, especially our younger population that are now coming up. It's imperative, I would say, and I do advocate for that vaccine.
So I always will say that we can actually save the future generation from essentially getting cervical cancer. We can prevent them from getting these head and neck cancers related to HPV.
That's right. And
some of these are horrible. And as you said, they present late many times and just in surgical intervention. You need radical surgery. You can lose your tongue. You can lose your vocal cords. You can lose part of your jaw. This is major transformative, and then I mean that in a negative way, surgery, just in many cases for palliation.
Yes.
So don't go through that. You don't want to have radiation to your head and neck as well. All of this can be avoided. Don't smoke. Don't have multiple partners. Practice safe sex. And obviously, if you've gone beyond the age in your 30s and you've had multiple partners or in your relationship, HPV vaccine is really not going to be of much benefit. But your children, once they're 11, 12, 13, boys and girls.
That's right.
There's a misunderstanding that this is only for girls. Mm-hmm. Even if you, as a male, get HPV, you can give that HPV to your loved one, your wife, your girlfriend, and they can develop cervical cancer. And you don't want to live with that burden on your heart that happened. And you might, in many cases, you're not even aware that you have HPV. Mm-hmm. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted disease on earth.
That's right.
And that's not even close to any other STI. And we can eradicate it. Why no one's getting the HPV vaccine or it's a rarity, I just don't understand. If I could one day wake up and hear a miracle happen and there's a vaccine for prostate cancer, I'd be on Bay Street Arts.
That's right.
I'd go in business to business. I'd be in the food store. Please, let's get this. Let's save your life. Let's save a generation from dying needlessly of prostate cancer. We are telling you now, you can stop the next generation and our younger generation now from getting cervical cancer with almost certainty. But yet every week women are being diagnosed with stage 3, stage 4 cancer and dying a painful, prolonged, needless death. Younger persons, middle-aged persons are coming in with head and neck cancers many times. They're HPV. Let's stop this madness. I just don't understand this. It's readily available in clinic. Go to any internist, private physician. Anyone who's a physician can check you to get the HPV vaccine, and it can save your life, save the life of someone you know. And I don't know what more we cervical cancer gets to get HPV vaccine. Neck cancer is related to HPV. Horrible death.
Yes.
It's a horrible, horrible death. So when we talk about, what are some of the benign conditions in terms of masses related to the thyroid gland itself, and how common are they?
So are very, very, mostly benign. 95% of them will be benign, right? So we have adenomas, we have multinodular goiter, and then we can have diffuse enlargement. So these, remember, the thyroid is a gland of a particular form and a gland of a particular function. So with these nodules, we normally leave them alone after we ultrasound them and they look benign. So there are certain features on the ultrasound that would make us say, well, this nodule is not a dominant nodule. It's not an aggressive. It doesn't look suspicious. And so there are particular features. That ultrasound is so key. It's actually more sensitive than the CT scan that we would send patients for, because we can see the architecture of that nodule. And so once we don't see anything deleterious or untoward on that nodule, then we deem it benign. Additionally, if we do see anything that might be a bit off, we can biopsy it. Now, the biopsy process is not a tedious process. It's simply looking at the ultrasound machine and passing a small needle, just like taking a blood sample for 30 seconds, and that gives us cells. And we can look at those cells from that nodule, and tells us if it's anything serious, like a lesion that may be suspicious, or if it's just a benign nodule. And so those confirmatory tests allow us to leave these nodules alone in the patient's neck, and we don't have to operate on these patients. Now, when it comes to benign lesions of the thyroid, we have to make sure, again, that the blood tests are normal, because they may look benign, the neck may not be getting larger, but they may be hyperthyroid, they may be hypothyroid. So you always want to have an approach where you need to supplement if need be, or you need to reduce, give antithyroid medication. Because if these patients are hyperthyroid, there are medications that we can give them to make them normal. If they're hypothyroid, then we can supplement with hormone tablets in the form of hormone replacement therapy that we can give them. So a lot of these nodules are very benign. Nothing needs to be done, but it's incumbent on us to make sure that the function is also normal.
So let's explain to the audience, what is it between the parathyroid gland and the thyroid gland? There's a lot of confusion out there. What is the function of both?
Right. So the parathyroid is called the parathyroid because it's the buddy of the thyroid gland. It sits right next to, and the thyroid is one gland, and there are, in 95% of us, four parathyroid glands. So it's 4-1. The only thing is, the thyroid, for reference of size, the size of a car, and which would then be the size of the tires on that car, the four tires. So in relation of size, they're very small compared to the thyroid gland. And so usually they sit right on the back side of the thyroid gland. And when we operate, it's so important for us to find these four glands and preserve them, because they help us with our calcium metabolism and homeostasis. They help us to keep our calcium at the normal level. And sometimes if you're not careful and you remove some of these parathyroids, what can happen is your calcium levels can drop. And so you don't want, after having performed thyroid surgery, the patient start to have symptoms of hypocalcemia. So it's so important to find all four of these and document that they've been found. Now, parathyroid disease versus thyroid disease are two separate entities. Yes, they are closely related, but they do differ in function. So one deals with calcium, the other one with metabolism. And so you have to be very careful when you're operating to not confuse the two.
We said a lot, and you were very comprehensive and right to the point. I think the audience appreciates everything that you, all of us. If you want to make an appointment to see you, what is the best way to make an appointment to see you?
So you can go online at BahamasENT.com, and you can book an appointment to see me, or you can WhatsApp 423-5513. So I'm available by way of private, as well as I work in the public system at PMH as well, serving those patients, which I proudly do. So either one way or another, if you need me, I am available and very happy to be home to help my people.
And this is Junior, Dr. Charles Johnson Jr. As your dad is an ENT surgeon as well. Yes,
that's right.
This is Junior who's in the studio right now.
That's right.
And please, you must come again. I think we need to do at least a three-part series on then all of these things. But if you just want to summarize, what would you like to tell the audience in terms of what you're seeing in ENT and what can they do to look out for and what can we do to change the tide of things that you are very concerned about?
Yes, so definitely with head and neck cancer, please limit the smoking and alcohol. With the sinus, I think we all need to have, at least if it's just a one sit down talk with your ENT, myself, about how we can control your symptoms. Because a lot of the time it just comes down to how we're taking the medication. And then your symptoms would be so much improved. And so with that, as well as with the sleep apnea, we just need to step on the scale, watch our weight, and have that discussion with your ENT, and you'll be just fine.
Yes, so sleep apnea is a multidisciplinary approach. Look at the pulmonologist, the dentist, ENT, the urologist, the endocrinologist.
Yes.
It affects so many different, but essentially what we're saying is it's going to ruin your life. It's going to take your life before it's your time. Don't live your life like that. Thank you very much, Dr. Charles Johnson Jr., ENT specialist and head and neck surgeon. This is Dr. Gregory Pinto, behavior urologist, and this is Urologist Speaks. See you again next week, and good evening.
Put lead in your pencil, make you feel like a champion.